Anglo-American Unity. A speech on receiving an honorary degree at Harvard University. Heard in Britain by shortwave radio, September the 6th, 1943.
Mr. Colonel, Mr. Governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, gentlemen of the university, ladies and gentlemen, here assembled. The last time I attended a ceremony of this character was in the spring of 1941, when as Chancellor of Bristol University, I conferred a degree upon the United States Ambassador Wyden, and in absentia upon our President, who is here today and presiding over this ceremony. Here now, today, I am once again in academic groves. Groves is, I believe, the right word. Where knowledge is garnered, where learning is stimulated, where virtues are inculcated and thought encouraged. Here in the broad United States, with a respectable ocean on either side of us, we can look out upon the world in all its wonder and in all its woe. But what is this that I discern as I pass through your streets, as I look round this great company? I see uniforms on every side. I understand that nearly the whole energy of the university have been drawn into the preparation of American youth for the battlefield. For this purpose, all classes, courses have been transformed, and even the most sacred vacations have been swept away in a round the year and almost round the clock drive to make warriors and technicians for the fighting front. Twice in my lifetime, the long arm of destiny has reached across the oceans and involved the entire life and manhood of the United States in a deadly struggle. There was no use saying, we don't want it, we won't have it. Our forebears left Europe to avoid these quarrels. We have founded a new world which has no contact with the old. There was no use in that. The long arm reaches out remorselessly, and everyone's existence, environment, and outlook undergoes a swift and irresistible change. The people of the United States cannot escape world responsibility. Although we live in a period so tumultuous that little can be predicted, we may be quite sure that this process will be intensified with every forward step the United States make in wealth and in power. Not only are the responsibilities of this great republic growing, but the world over which they reign is itself contracting in relation to our powers of locomotion at a positively alarming rate. We have learned to fly. What prodigious changes are involved in that new accomplishment? Man has parted company with his trusty friend, the horse, and has sailed into the azure with the eagles. Eagles being represented by the internal combustion engine. Where then are those broad oceans of vast staring deserts? They are shrinking beneath our very eyes. Even elderly parliamentarians like myself are forced to acquire a high degree of mobility. But to the youth of America and to the youth of all the Britons, I say, you cannot stop. There's no halting place at this point. We'll now reach the point in the journey where there can be no pause. We must go on. It must be world anarchy or world order. Throughout all this ordeal and struggle, which is characteristic of our age, you will find in the British Commonwealth and Empire good comrades to whom you are united by other ties besides those of state policy and public need. To a large extent, there are the ties of blood and history. But naturally, I, a child of both worlds, am conscious of these. Law, language, literature, these are considerable factors. Common conceptions of what is right and decent, a marked regard for fair play, especially to the weak and poor, a stern sentiment of impartial justice, and above all, the love of personal freedom, or as Kipling put it, leave to live by no man's leave underneath the law. These are common conceptions on both sides of the ocean among the English-speaking people. We hold to these conceptions as strongly as you do. At the present time, we have that in continual vigorous action, the British and United States combined Chiefs of Staff Committee, which works immediately under the President and myself as representative of the British War Cabinet. This committee, with its elaborate organization of staff officers of every grade, disposes of all our resources, and in practice uses British and American troops, ships, aircraft, and munitions just as if they were the resources of a single state or nation. This is a wonderful system. There was nothing like it in the last war. There never has been anything like it between two allies. It is reproduced in an even more tightly knit form at General Eisenhower's headquarters in the Mediterranean, where everything is completely intermingled, and soldiers are ordered into battle by the Supreme Commander or his deputy, General Alexander, without the slightest regard as to whether they are British, American, or Canadian, but simply in accordance with the fighting need. Now, in my opinion, it would be a most foolish and improvident act on the part of our two governments, or either of them, to break up this smooth-running and immensely powerful machinery the moment the war is over. For our own safety, as well as for the security of the rest of the world, we are bound to keep it working and in running order after the war, probably for a good many years, not only till we have set up some world arrangement to keep the peace, but until we know that it is an arrangement which will really give us that protection we must have from danger and aggression, a protection we have already had to seek across two vast world wars. The great Bismarck, there were once great men in Germany, is said to have observed towards the close of his life that the most potent factor in human society at the end of the 19th century was the fact that the British and American people spoke the same language. That was a pregnant saying. Certainly it has enabled us to wage war together with an intimacy and harmony never before achieved among allies. This gift of a common tongue is a priceless inheritance, and it may well someday become the foundation of a common citizenship. I like to think of British and Americans moving about freely over each other's wide estates with hardly a sense of being foreigners to one another. But I do not see why we should not try to spread our common language even more widely throughout the globe, and without seeking selfish advantage over any, possess ourselves of this invaluable amenity and birthright. Some months ago, I persuaded the British Cabinet to set up a committee of ministers to study and report upon basic English. What was my delight when the other evening, quite unexpectedly, I heard the President of the United States suddenly speak of the merits of basic English. And is it not a coincidence that with all this in mind, I should arrive at Harvard in fulfillment of the long-dated invitation to receive this degree with which President Truman has honored me? Because the Harvard Commission on English Language Studies is distinguished both for its research and practical work, particularly in introducing the use of basic English in Latin America. And this commission, your commission, is now, I am told, working with the secondary schools in Boston on the use of basic English in teaching the main language to American children and in teaching it to foreigners preparing for citizenship. Gentlemen, I make you my compliment. I do not wish to exaggerate, but you are at the headstrings of what might well be a mighty, a fertilizing, and a health-giving river. It would certainly be a grand convenience for us all to be able to move freely about the world. And we shall be able to do more freely than ever known before as the science of the world develops, to be able to move freely about the world and to find everywhere a medium, albeit primitive, of intercourse and understanding. Might it not also be an advantage to many races and an aid to the building up of our new structure for preserving peace? All these are great possibilities. And I say, let us go into this together. Now, let us have another Boston Tea Party about it. Let us go forward as with other matters, similar in aim and effect. Let us go forward in malice to none and with goodwill to all. Such plans offer far better prizes than taking away other people's provinces or land or grinding them down in exploitation. The empires of the future are the empires of the mind. We have learned from hard experience that stronger, more efficient, more rigorous world institutions must be created to preserve peace and to forestall the causes of future wars. In this task, the strongest victorious nations must be combined, and also those who have borne the burden and heat of the day and suffered under the flail of adversity. And in this creative task, there are some who say, let us have a world council and under it regional or continental councils. And there are others who prefer a somewhat different organization. All these matters weigh with us now, in spite of the war, which none can say has reached its climax, which is perhaps entering for us, British and Americans, upon its most severe and costly phase. But I am here to tell you that whatever form your system of world security may take, however the nations are grouped and ranged, whatever derogations are made from national sovereignty for the sake of the larger synthesis, nothing will work soundly or for long without the united effort of the British and American people. Let us rise to the full level of our duty and of our opportunity, and let us thank God for the spiritual rewards he has granted for all forms of valiant and faithful service.